So, in our culture, we're told to strive for progress, not perfection. Try to eat when you're hungry and stop when you're full. Maybe you should eat well 90% of the time and indulge 10% of the time. Do you know that there's a big problem with that advice? Here's what the problem is. Willpower is a fatigable muscle. It's not like an on and off switch. It's more like gas you have in the tank. And it's fatigued over the course of the day by every decision that you make, not just food decisions. People have trouble resisting marshmallows after we make them do math problems. Decision making fatigues our willpower.
You're listening to the Addicted to Fitness podcast, brought to you by Elemental Training Tampa. Now, here's your hosts, Nick and Shannon Birch.
Thanks for stopping by and checking out another edition of the Addicted to Fitness podcast. We have a great interview episode for you guys today. Before we jump into another conversation with a fitness and health pro, we want to talk to you guys about, or tell you guys about, another source of great health info and product recommendations, and that is
addictedtofitnesspodcast.com.
That's right. You almost forgot it, right?
No, I almost stumbled because I was listening to our wonderful pets.
Yes. In our soundproof studio.
Right, yes.
Now. So, yeah, addictedtofitnesspodcast.com. That is where you guys will find all the show notes for each episode, including today's, which are really a great resource for kind of investigating the topics we talk about on each episode.
Yeah, I listened to podcasts for a long time before I actually realized that show notes are basically just like the cliff notes sort of of a show, and all of those like sources and you know, if you hear some interesting words and they say, "Oh yeah, we'll link it in the notes." Like that's what they're talking about. It's basically just a nice little repository of all of the highlights.
Repository. That is a fancy word.
I use that word quite frequently.
All right. Well, you're fancy. So, but as we mentioned, addictedtofitnesspodcast.com, it's got our shop page also, which we have our ATF-approved products, which you guys can check out.
Yes, and those are the products that we've already gone through the pain and diligence of testing out for you and giving very honest, like, kind of hardcore approvals. None of them are paid advertisers by any means. They're just products we love. So, and it's an Amazon affiliate. So obviously we appreciate that support just because any of that kind of affiliate bonus goes towards this podcast.
That's right. Yeah. And you'll see our other affiliates, Stick Mobility and the Hemp Coffee Exchange, on that shop page also. So, well, as we mentioned right when we started this episode, we've got another great interview with a health and fitness pro. Today's interview is with Dr. Glenn Livingston. And
it's a great last name.
Livingston?
I don't know why, but that just, like, it sounds intelligent to me.
Well, he was intelligent, I'll tell you what. So, but it was a great, I'm glad we actually were contacted through our email by Dr. Glenn and his booking company to come on the podcast. And once I read a little bit more of his background, I really wanted to, I was excited to talk to him because we've talked about obesity on the podcast a lot, about statistics and, you know, what possible causes of obesity, but we've never taken it really from the psychological aspect or the psychological direction.
Yeah.
Is that kind of the more better way to describe it? Because, you know, it's...
Perspective.
Good.
It's the perspective.
Because, obviously, we think it's all about, you know, a person's willpower or... you know, just food choices or not being able to control themselves, but it goes much deeper than that due to the type of, you know, what kind of food we are kind of inundated with today or nowadays in modern times, and what it does to our psyche and kind of how we're not really responsible. We're kind of
in a way,
and we're gonna go over all the
conditioning
details
in our society.
So it's the conversation I had with Dr. Glenn was very informative and broke it down from really that psychological perspective of why it's really, you know, his expertise is working with binge eaters or emotional eaters. So he really takes it from, you know, he's a psychotherapist, so he takes it from the psychological, the mental aspects and addresses it, which is, you know, according to him, and he's helped many people, is really the key to kind of eating any diet you really want. And when we say diet, we're talking about, you know, food choices, whether you're paleo, vegan, so on and so forth. Eating any type of the diet you want, but then being able to have the mental strength to prevent things like binge eating and overeating. So yeah, obviously he'll go into much more detail in the conversation, but I was glad we got to talk to him because it's like I said, we've never really taken it from this approach before.
Yeah, I mean, neither of us have psychological training.
No.
You know, I mean, we have a lot of like health, fitness, dietary trainings and research and things in our backgrounds, but this is absolutely. I mean, this is science of the brain.
Yeah, and this is it's to the point where we have to kind of take it from this perspective. It's not just a thing that, you know, tell people to, you know, doing a 30-day juice cleanse or anything. You got to take it from a mental aspect because you're trying to create a lifestyle, not just a temporary fix.
Well, this will definitely be a great interview, I think, for anybody who is interested in the topic of obesity and kind of getting to the real root of it. So I say let's jump on it without any further ado.
That's right. All right. As you said, without further ado, here's our conversation with Dr. Glenn Livingston. My guest today is a veteran psychologist, health coach, and author of the book, Never Binge Again. I'm very excited to welcome Dr. Glenn Livingston to the Addicted to Fitness podcast. How are you doing today, Dr. Day? How are you doing today, Dr. Glenn?
I am Dr. Doing Good.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear it.
Really happy to be here. Yeah.
I'm super interested in talking to you, especially because of your approach to overeating, the psychology approach to overeating. And but first, I wanted to kind of touch on something that we both kind of share. We had our own kind battles with obesity and overweight, being overweight. And I was curious what that was like for you, and then how it kind of what event led you to saying enough is enough and changing essentially your mindset.
Yeah, well, how it was for me was freaking awful, not in the beginning, but as it developed. I struggled with it for 30 years. I'm 54 years old now, and when I was a teenager, I'm 6'4". I'm fairly muscular, and I like to work out. And I discovered that if I worked out for 2 or 3 hours a day, that I could eat whatever I wanted to. You know, 6,000 or 7,000 calories, 2 pizzas, a box of muffins, a box of donuts, a whole bunch of lattes. They didn't call them lattes back then. Chocolate bars, anything that wasn't nailed down. If I wanted to eat it, I could eat it. And it didn't bother me. I thought it was a great trick that I had. But as I got older and I got married and I had patients and I had a commute, I found that I didn't have time to work out more than maybe 2 hours a week, much less 2 hours a day. But I couldn't stop eating and I couldn't stop thinking about food the way that I always been thinking about food. And I got fatter and fatter and fatter. And the doctors were yelling at me because my triglycerides skyrocketed. They were above 1,100 at one point, I believe. I've got a test over 800. And they said, look, you know, all your ancestors have heart attacks in their 40s. That's the path that you're headed for, except I think you're going to do it in your 30s. And worse than that, I come from a family of 17 psychologists and psychotherapists, and my mom and my dad and my sister and my aunts and my uncles and my cousins and my in-laws and my stepbrothers and sisters. Everyone is a freaking shrink. And being a psychologist has always been really, really important to me. But you have to be 100% present, especially with really risky patients. So when I was working with suicidal people or people right after the aftermath of an affair, I'd be sitting there and I really was trying to be 100% present, but I just kept thinking about when can I get to the pizza place? You know, ooh, when my break, I'm going to go get some donuts. And it was awful. Well, I tried everything you could imagine to love myself then. Being a psychologist, if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And I went to some of the best doctors in New York City, because I lived in and around there, and I knew a lot of them because of my connections in the family. And I went to a psychiatrist and took some medication, and I went to Overeaters Anonymous for a couple of years, and I got help in some ways. Like, it was a very soulful journey. I learned things about myself. There would be periods when I'd lose a little bit of weight, but it never really stopped the addiction. Eventually, I don't have kids and I never commuted. Eventually, I had developed a second career as a corporate consultant, and I was doing a lot of large marketing research projects. So I had the machinery at my disposal to conduct those projects. And I decided I was going to do a giant survey on the internet to figure out what the emotional difficulties were behind the particular foods that people craved. So I asked people what they craved. I asked them about different life areas of satisfaction. I asked them about a whole bunch of different personality issues. And I found three really interesting things. One thing was that people who struggled with chocolate like me, because most of my binges always started with chocolate, they tended to feel lonely or brokenhearted or fairly depressed, but interpersonally depressed about relationships and things like that. And that made sense because I was in a bad marriage, and I decided I would go back to my mom and ask her, since she was also a psychotherapist, well, you know, mom, look, I'm struggling with this marriage, but what is it in my upbringing that could have set up this pattern where I feel lonely or upset and I run to chocolate? And she got this horrible look on her face, and she said, Glenn, I'm so sorry, I'm so ashamed, but when you were about a year old, your father was a captain in the Army, and they were talking about sending him to Vietnam, and I was terrified. Worse than that, my father, your grandfather, he'd just gotten out of prison, and he was guilty. And I'd adored him my whole life. He was my inspiration. I didn't know he was doing these things, and I was horribly depressed about that. And so when you came to me crying, wanting food, I just didn't have the wherewithal to love you and hold you. So I got a refrigerator, and I kept it on the floor, and I put a big bottle of chocolate Bosco syrup in the refrigerator, and I'd say, Glenn, go get your Bosco. And you'd go running to the bottle of chocolate syrup, crawling actually, and you'd take it out of the refrigerator, and you'd suck on the bottle, and you'd go into a chocolate sugar coma. I mean, yeah, and I was like, right?
Yeah, so I mean, you associated essentially soothing with chocolate.
That's how it all got set up.
Wow.
But Nick, you know what? If this were the movies, you'd expect that my mom and I would have a big hug and a big cry, and I'd never have chocolate again, right? Or never have trouble with it again.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we had a hug and a cry, and I forgave her, and she forgave herself, and I was softer on myself after that. I forgave myself for the problem, but it actually made the problem worse. And the reason why is because there was this little voice in my head, and that voice would say things like, you know what, Glenn? You're right. Your mama didn't love you, and she left a big chocolate-sized hole in your heart. And until you can find the love of your life, you're going to have to go right on binging on chocolate. Let's go get some right now. Yippee! What I learned from that was that it didn't really matter what the match was that struck the fire. It's interesting. It's soulful. It's a worthwhile conversation to have. But it doesn't necessarily put out the fire. The reason it doesn't put out the fire is twofold. First, because there's that voice that rationalizes the binge. So people think that emotional upsets cause a binge, but they really don't. They can cause a desire to binge. What really causes the binge is the rationalization that it's okay. And you can learn how to disempower that voice, which is almost always irrational. You can learn how to disempower that voice a lot more easily than you can find the love of your life or fix the emotional upsets. The other reason that understanding the emotional dynamics behind your binging doesn't fix the binging is because these foods have a life of their own. I consulted for industry for a lot of years, a lot of big food companies. I can tell you for a fact that there are billions and billions of dollars, perhaps trillions, that go into engineering these hyper palatable food-like substances. They're
right.
They're Yeah.
No, I was definitely going to ask you about that because with your experience, I mean, I think there was a book called The Dorito Effect where they talk about a lot of the things that I'm sure you experienced about, like you said, making things super palatable. Were there anything specific that you know with your experience? Was there a certain food that was like that they created specifically to make people want to eat until they – I mean, even not until they're full, but till they just ran out, essentially.
I'll give you an example. They're all concentrations of starch and sugar and oil and excitotoxins and salt and chemicals and artificial flavors. And they're engineering to figure out what your bliss point is, but they're not putting enough nutrition in there to really give you the satisfaction. So your body's going to still want something else. So it's really hijacking your survival drive. The thing that really crystallized for me as most heinous was when the VP of a major food bar manufacturer told me that their biggest profitable insight was to take the vitamins out of the bar and put the money into the packaging instead. The vitamins were making the bar taste worse, even though they were better for people, and they could fake vitamins. You see, when you see a vibrancy of colors on a food, it's actually supposed to signal a diversity of nutrients that are available in the wild. So when you have a salad with carrots and beets and radishes and apples and greens and, you know, a diversity of color, mm-hmm. you're getting a diversity of nutrients. That's what that evolutionary mechanism evolved to detect. And that's why we like a vibrancy of colors when we look for food packaging. Mm-hmm. Well, when you take vitamins out of a food and you put the colors into the packaging, I think that's parasitic marketing. I think that you're faking out the customer and you're fooling them into thinking this is what they need to survive, when in actuality, you're giving them air. So,
definitely. No, I agree. I mean, that's it. And it's interesting because I've heard reports and I've heard other conversations about how little information or accurate information they have to give on labels, nutrition labels. You know, I think it seems like there's kind of workarounds, especially for, I'm sure, some of the companies you used to consult for, where they could say all natural or maybe even organic on it, but it's only, you know, a small percentage of the ingredients are organic or something in that nature or in that realm, is that they can really stretch the truth with all the labeling and packaging.
Oh yeah. I mean, even things like even the word caged free or something, and people have this vision of these happy chickens on a farm someplace, but all that means is that the chickens have access to the outside, I think, for 5 minutes a day. And it can be one small opening. There could be 10,000 chickens in a pen, and you know, they can be walking around on their own filth, and there can be one small opening that they can get out for a couple of minutes a day. And then, you know, the government says that's okay to call that cage free. So I think the word organic is more strictly regulated. I think that's actually it's a reasonable measure. It's not a perfect measure. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, if you really want to be safe, then don't eat food with a label on it. That's what it comes down to.
You got to kind of gather or trap your own food. That's well, the results or the choices.
You know, like Doug Graham says, whole, fresh, ripe, raw, organic plant foods. That's kind of my philosophy. My book is not, it doesn't promote any particular diet. My book is all about a psychological mindset to stick to any diet that you want to. I happen to be plant-based, but I work with a lot of people that are paleo and have different dietary philosophies, because I'm not a nutritionist and I'm not really equipped to argue those points as well as a nutritionist really would. But yeah, no, it's shameful. It's really depressing what's going on. So these foods have a life of their own. And then there are billions of dollars of advertising that go into convincing you that you can't live without it. And most people think advertising doesn't affect them, but guess what? Advertising affects you more when you think it doesn't affect you, because your sales resistance is down. So there's the advertising industry, and then the addiction treatment industry says you can't resist even if you wanted to. The best you could do is abstain one day at a time. And if you're having trouble, it's because you've got a chronic, progressive, mysterious disease, and the only cure is this spiritual stuff. And you can abstain one day at a time and progress, not perfection. And I think it's just creating the perfect storm and making it next to impossible for people to eat well.
Yeah, I agree. And I wanted to find out, because obviously your book, Never Binge Again, I was looking at the reviews, looking at the kind of the testimonials that they gave. It was, you know, that a lot of people couldn't believe how – I don't say how simple it was, but how your approach was – it's like how somebody couldn't see that. And once they started practicing kind of the approach you were giving in the book, that it made it so much easier for them to control their cravings and stop that overeating. I'm curious to know what your approach is and how anyone can stop them, regardless of their diet plan, can choose or stop the binge eating cycle.
Well, it's a little embarrassing because I'm a sophisticated psychologist and I've done all of this corporate consulting, and I've published all these papers, and I've, you know, done all this speaking. But here's how I solved my problem in the end. I was reading a lot of alternative addiction treatment literature because I had just come out of Overeaters Anonymous, where it's worked a little bit, and then it made things worse, and came to find that the only controlled research on those 12-step programs suggest that they're at parity or worse than doing nothing at all, which was shocking to me. So I looked for alternative addiction treatment literature, and I found a guy named Jack Trimpe who wrote a book called Rational Recovery. And he works mostly with drugs and alcohol, it seems. You know, the types of addictions that you can quit entirely, as opposed to food, where you have to take the lion out of the cage a few times a day, walk it around the block. And he shifted my paradigm. He made me realize that I was trying to love myself thin. And this corresponded with what I figured out in the research I was doing. And what he said was that the seat of addiction is really the lizard brain. And the lizard brain is a bodily organ that doesn't really know love. The lizard brain evolved, and that, now I'm going afield from what he says, but it's in concert with what he's saying. He said the lizard brain evolved, and initially it only assessed the stimulus in the environment for eat, mate, or kill. When the lizard brain saw something, it says, do I eat it, do I mate with it, or do I kill it? There's no love there. There's no long-term goals or aspirations. There's no weight loss plan. There's no tribe or family or spirituality or music or art or contribution to society or philosophy or anything we more traditionally think of as human. It's just eat, mate, or kill. It wasn't until later in our evolution, when the other parts of the brain developed, that we had the ability to delay the lizard brain's impulses for the purpose of asking, how is this going to impact my loved ones? How is this going to impact the tribe? What will this do to my long-term goals and the kind of person I'm trying to be in this world? And that was in the mammalian brain, and that was in the neocortex, the logical brain. And what he said was, he says, look, you don't need to love this thing. You need to dominate it. This is like being an alpha wolf, and there's a wolf challenging for leadership in the pack. The right attitude is not, oh, poor baby, you must be feeling unloved that you're craving chocolate. The right attitude is, get back in line or I'll kill you, right? Mm-hmm. If you ever look at an alpha wolf being challenged for leadership, that there is no love there. And that was a paradigm shift for me. That was a piercing insight. And I realized that what I needed to do was figure out how to make food a more black and white issue so that I could use something similar. And so this is the embarrassing part. I decided that my lizard brain, I was going to call it my pig. And I was going to draw a clear line in the sand. For example, I will never give chocolate except for Sundays again. And that if I heard anything in my head that suggested that I should have chocolate on a Wednesday, that was going to be pig squeal. The chocolate itself was going to be pig slop. And I would say, I don't eat pig slop, that's pig squeal, and I don't listen to farm animals telling me what to do. So, and this is all just an inner mental construct, by the way.
Quite the vocabulary, though. I like it.
Yeah. Well, and I just want to make sure that I mention that I'm not talking about real pigs. Real pigs are a very sweet animal. I'm really talking about your lizard brain, and I happen, unfortunately, to call mine my pig. Right. You can call it you can call it your food monster or your food demon, whatever you want to call it. It doesn't really matter.
You're just kind of personifying that part of your brain in order to make it a little bit more, I wouldn't say realistic, but you can have it tangible, I guess, to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I know, that seems very creative. Please go on. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
So at the moment of impulse, what I wanted to do was wake up, and I found that this was working. So if I was standing in line at Starbucks and there was a chocolate bar on the counter and I heard something in my head that said, you know, you could start that diet tomorrow. I say, wait a minute, that's pig's wheel. Chocolate is pig slop. I don't eat pig slop. I don't let farm animals tell me what to do. And that very primitive mantra would help me to remember. Just gave me some extra microseconds before I acted on it. Remember who I was, who I wanted to be around food and around that particular food. And then I'd make the right decision. Not every time. It wasn't a miracle. But slowly but surely, I recovered my sense of power. And I started to research more about, you know, how the food industry was addicting the lizard brain and what the natural consequences of short-circuiting the evolutionary pleasure mechanisms were in animal studies. Those consequences, by the way, were that the animals completely neglected their survival needs. If you put an electrode in the pleasure center of a mammal's brain and you let that mammal push a button or press a lever to self-stimulate, they just want to press that button all day long thousands of times. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if they're starving, they won't eat their food. It doesn't matter if they're nursing their pups, they won't take care of the pups. They just want to press that button. And I think if you look at, I don't think it's a far cry to say the bags and boxes and containers that were being given by the food industry and the advertising industry are akin to those pleasure buttons. And you look at people who say, well, I could just never eat fruit and vegetables. I don't even like them, because they like those bags and boxes and containers instead. There is a profiteer, you know, some big person with a mustache and a white suit who's laughing all the way to the bank that you don't like fruit and vegetables anymore, that you want to eat these industrial foods for profit. So
no, it's visible nowadays since unfortunately the obesity epidemic that, you know, its latest reports are over, I think we're approaching 35%, which I know is based on BMI, which is somewhat of an outdated measurement, but still it's increasing, which is the alarming effect. And on top of chronic diseases like type 2 diabetes, and then, people are developing, children are developing like, it's not cirrhosis, but liver disease at an early age due to high sugar intake. Those kind of trends that are happening, you're seeing it. And are people shocked when your clients come in and they speak with you and you give them this information about, you know, since you have that experience with the food industries, are people shocked when they hear this from you, or do some of them know and they just, it's that the food essentially has their hooks in them?
Most of them know. Most of the people that come to me know. What they're shocked at is that there's nothing necessarily wrong with them. See, I don't believe in the disease concept of overeating. I don't think you're broken if you can't stop eating. I think that you're a natural victim. You're someone with a healthy appetite, not a diseased appetite, but a healthy appetite, who has fallen prey to the industrial foods. And I try to help them to start to turn their shame into anger. And that's very relieving for people. You know, you can opt out of this. And you don't have to opt out by completely eliminating the foods that you love. There, in many cases, you can just think through the exact role that you want that food to play. Personally, I don't eat chocolate at all anymore. It was just easier not to have it, and I haven't had it in years, and it looks like a big bag of chemicals to me. I don't even want it. But for a lot of people, they want to be able to have chocolate on social occasions, or they want to have it on Saturdays, or, you know, if they want to go out to eat and have a dessert, they want to be able to do that. And the trick there has been defining exactly when and how much they'll have, and avoiding putting themselves in the tempting situation and still having to make the decisions once they get there.
We're leading into, there was something I was watching on your Facebook page, which is, I'm going to give that out real quick. It says, Never Binge Again is the Facebook page, I believe. Yes. Never Binge Again. And I was watching a video on there, and you were talking about the lizard brain, but you were also talking about your four simple food rules. And I was curious to know if you'd be willing to share that, or share those.
Well, I have people start by making one rule, and I ask them what the most significant food problem they have is, most significant trigger food or eating behavior is. And for some people, that's chocolate. For other people, it's bread. For other people, it's not a particular food, but it's how they eat. So, and then I'll have them make a rule about it, like I'll never eat standing up again, or I will only ever have chocolate on a Sunday, or I will always have 6 servings of fruit and vegetables every calendar day for my life, for the rest of my days. So, and there are 4 categories of rules that I suggest you might consider. You can use others if you can come up with it, but I have never rules. Those are things you'll never do again. I have always rules. I have sometimes or conditional rules, and then I have unrestricted rules. And I like people to think through what they might like to have in those 4 categories. People get frightened of the finality of the words never and always. And so what I need to explain when I introduce that is that we are committing with perfection but forgiving ourselves with dignity. And also, we're presenting our rules to our pig as if they are set in stone, because the pig acts like a 2-year-old. And if you have a 2-year-old, you're going to tell that little boy or little girl, listen, little Sarah, you can't ever, 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 ever cross the street without holding daddy's hand. Never. You can never cross the street without holding daddy's hand. The reason you tell them that, even though you know in a couple of years you're probably going to teach them to look both ways, or maybe 5 years you'll teach them to look both ways and do it themselves, is they're not mature enough to consider the impulse to cross the street. It's too dangerous. It's the same thing with our pigs. Our pigs are not mature enough. At the moment of impulse, with the strength of these industrial foods and the strength of the biological drive that they touch, we don't have the ability to consider, gee, maybe we'll have this, maybe we won't, or maybe someday we will. You just want to be able to push it out of your mind entirely, even though you can change the plan later on if you want to, just like you can teach your little girl to cross the street when you're ready. So it's how we talk to the pig. It's not really the plan we have for ourselves for eternity. And once I explain that to people, it makes a lot more sense and they're less frightened of doing that. So those are the 4 categories: never, always, sometimes, and unrestricted. And I do very much recommend rules as opposed to guidelines. Do you want me to talk a little bit about that, or was there someplace else you wanted to go?
Sure. Nick? No, that please go ahead.
So in our culture, we're told to strive for progress, not perfection. Try to eat when you're hungry and stop when you're full. Maybe you should eat well 90% of the time and indulge 10% of the time. Do you know that there's a big problem with that advice? Here's what the problem is. Willpower is a fatigable muscle. It's not like an on and off switch. It's more like gas you have in the tank. And it's fatigued over the course of the day by every decision that you make, not just food decisions. People have trouble resisting marshmallows after we make them do math problems. Decision making fatigues our willpower. When you say, I will only eat when I'm hungry and stop when I'm full, it's a good guideline. It's a nice way to live. But it's not something that you can... It wears down your willpower, because every time you have to decide if you're hungry or you're full. If you say, I avoid chocolate 90% of the time, every time you're in front of a chocolate bar, you have to make another decision and you're wearing down your willpower. Whereas if you say, I will never eat chocolate except for Sunday again, you don't have to make chocolate decisions on Monday through Saturday. You don't have to expend any willpower to do that. What happens is, it's the difference between trying to do something and becoming the kind of person who just does it. Like, I'll never eat chocolate again. I don't try not to have chocolate. I'm just not the kind of person who eats chocolate. It's part of my character. It's become part of who I am. We all have character traits that we've adopted to help us form habits that we don't even have to think about in the face of temptation. For example, if you go into a diner and there's a $20 bill on the table And the waitress hasn't seen it. It's her tip. And she says, I'll be right back. I just have to get you a menu. And there's no video camera, and there's nobody up front, and there's no window, and nobody would see you take that. Virtually everybody I talk to about that says they would not take that $20 bill. And I'll say, why? And they'll say, well, because I'm not a thief, that's why. This woman worked hard for her money, and I'm not going to take her money from her. And I said, do you have to exert a lot of willpower to do that? And they say, no, because I'm not a thief. It's not the kind of person that I am. It's not even a decision. We do the same thing for rape and murder and even just like social niceties. We don't run up and kiss attractive people that we see on the street just because we're attracted to them, just because our testicles or our ovaries are generating a drive that says, you know, we should be with them. We have something called a character, and we behave in a particular way to participate in a civilized society. And all I'm suggesting with these rules is that we add one more, that you start to incorporate elements of your eating into your character vis-a-vis rules-based behavior. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. I know before it was, you're making it a lifestyle choice, now just a temporary fix. So now you're choosing to live this way opposed to a 30-day no bread diet or, you know, 60-day juice cleanse or something of that nature. It's now a lifestyle choice, which we talk a lot about on the podcast, about how, you know, proper eating and proper, you know, a regular exercise plan is, it's the way you live. Incorporating that into your life it has to be the way you live now. It can't be just a temporary ideal.
Right.
Well, that's awesome. I really appreciate all the information you gave during this interview, Dr. Glenn. I want to ask you one question before we go, is if you had one piece of health advice to give our listeners, what would that be?
Leafy green vegetables, man. Just eat more of them. it's just like there's so many controversial things in nutrition and people argue about everything. But unless your doctor says you can't, leafy green vegetables.
There you go.
Get a half pound, put them in a blender, drink them down like medicine. You don't have to have a big salad with all sorts of fat and sugar and oil and stuff on it. Just get some more leafy greens and you'll feel better.
Wow, that's good. I love that piece of advice. I wasn't expecting that, so that's what makes it so good. Dr. Glenn, please give people all the information of how they can get a hold of you and your book and your website. And please, I want as many people to try to contact you if they need your help.
Okay. Well, my website is neverbingingend.com, and what I want you to do when you go there, so you can get a free copy of the book, is I want you to go to the big red button, click on the reader bonuses, and sign up for the reader bonuses. You'll get a free copy of the book in Kindle, Nook, or PDF format. You can also buy the book in paperback or Audible if you want to. But in addition to the book, because this is such a weird theory and it sounds so harsh as we just talk about it, I want you to hear it in action. So I've recorded a whole bunch of sessions, and I've got some people who allowed me to share that with you. And they're all free. And when you sign up at the Reader Bonuses, you'll start to get some of those sessions that you can listen to. And it's really wonderful to hear people's hope and enthusiasm being restored in just one session. In addition to that, we've created a set of food plan starter templates. This is also free, which is a set of rules for any particular dietary philosophy you could think of. So whether you're paleo, low carb, high carb, point counters, calorie counters, vegans, vegetarians, whatever it is, whatever your belief system is, there's probably a set of rules that will get you started. I call them starter templates as opposed to diets, because I'm not going to take responsibility for what you eat. I don't want your inner pig to be able to say, oh, well, Dr. Livingston's diet is not working. Obviously, we're going to have to find something else. But in the meantime, let's just go on a big hairy binge. No thanks. This is something you're going to have to think through for yourself and figure out, you know, what you want to eat. You know enough about health and nutrition at this point. I'm sure that Nick has some advice for you. And anyway, it's all at neverbingeagain.com. If you need to contact me directly, the contact button, if you leave a message there, it will get to me eventually. It goes through my customer support first. But periodically, people want to contact me directly, have an individual coaching or something like that, and we can do that. It's all at neverbingeagain.com. It's pretty easy.
Awesome. Dr. Lam, we'll make sure that keep or to include all your links to that website and to your social channels on the show notes for this episode. So if anybody is curious, you guys can looking for where to find Dr. Glenn, you can find him there on the addictedtofitnesspodcast.com website too, or go right to neverbingeagain.com. Dr. Glenn, thank you so much. It was truly an educational episode, and I love the idea of kind of taking ownership of that lizard brain and making it work for you opposed to against you. So I appreciate you coming on and sharing that with me.
It's easier and simpler than you think. And thank you for having me.
All right, Dr. Glenn, hopefully I'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, I hope so.
All right, thank you.
Be well.
Hope you guys enjoyed that conversation with Dr. Glenn Livingston. Like we mentioned before we got into the interview, that he was a wealth of knowledge about the mental kind of aspect of obesity and binge eating.
Definitely.
And honestly, when I was doing my personal training certification, they had some chapters on kind of emotional and mental, not disorders, but, you know, they classify like bulimia and anorexia as a mental disorder. I don't know if mental disorder, but condition to some.
Mental condition?
Yeah, because it's obviously, it has a lot to do with, you know, a psychological issue.
It's not really a physical issue so much as it is a psychological issue.
So, and I think emotional eating and binge eating to that kind of are on that platform also. Because it's like we said.
Definitely.
Like Dr. Glenn said, it's the food is so, you know, food companies, which he used to be a consultant for, they make food specifically We said it in their interview.
Palatable?
Thank you. Highly palatable. I just said it. Anyways, so they make food specifically highly palatable, and they also have ingenious marketing and packaging that actually kind of like turns on certain like attractive.
Which we have talked.
Yes, exactly.
About.
They turn and they have keywords and buzzwords on the labels that really turn people on and are like, oh, this is good for me. Yeah. And then those things combine with, as you know, Dr. Glenn said, the lizard brain, that part, the very first part of your brain that developed way, you know, thousands of years ago, that just basically they just eat, live, or die.
Yeah,
you know?
Which is really interesting because I don't feel like any of us really like think about the brain that way. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, that it evolved from this place of just be happy with what you've got to this point now where we're using food as so much more than just sustaining life.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like he was talking about, the lizard brain is like eat it or kill it. That's essentially, or maybe both, one before the other.
Yeah.
Anyways, but it's super interesting to think about how those foods from those, you know, processed foods have kind of tapped into our primitive part of our brain, and we have to kind of condition or program ourselves to turn off that primitive part of our brain in order to help us prevent binge eating.
We have to basically recondition ourselves, because how we're taught growing up is one thing, and that is ingrained.
Yeah, and that story he talked about in the beginning of the interview about how, you know, it was him and his mom, and his mom would soothe him with, you know, chocolate sauce.
Yeah.
Bosco? I think it was Bosco.
But, I mean, you see, like, I'm pretty sure, like, every single parent has done it at some point. They're like, here, have a cookie. Shut up. You know? Like, there's just always that instance where
you just want to soothe them somehow. You want them to be happy, and then when you find something that works, and even if it's food or sugar or whatever it may be, it's like, oh, well, this works. I know this works. So unfortunately, you could probably go back to the well too many times.
Yes. I mean, it's understandable. It's not as though, like, obviously we're not blaming anybody, but it's understandable that that's how it's been.
Yeah.
Because we have all this now available, but it is crazy to think how much reprogramming the brain needs in order to eat and have a better relationship with food.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's the idea that you can just do it by with your own willpower and just say, you know, I mean, there are people that are capable of that, but the deck is stacked against you for sure nowadays with the type of food system that we have, especially here in this country. So having people like Dr. Glenn Livingston out there to help coach you through and just give you the knowledge with, I mean, and his tools are simple, you know, and he gives out a lot of free, I mean, he gives a lot of free stuff out at neverbingeagain.com. That's his website. And you guys heard in the interview that he has a free ebook for there if you guys sign up for his email list. And also, additional free book. He has like free reader bonuses and free food plan starter templates with food rules for any type of dietary preferences. So paleo, vegan, all those ones, he can help you out. He's got kind of his not, it shouldn't be one size. It's not one size fit all. It's more, obviously, the approaches are, you know, focusing because everybody still has the same kind of, I guess, psychological starting point.
Yeah.
Especially when they're binge eating. You know, I don't know if there's a really differentiating from, you know, if you're a vegan binge eating from.
Yeah, I don't think that from a psychological standpoint, there is a difference so much as like what you're binging on. It's more to do with the reason.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why, and he has so many free resources at his website, neverbingeagain.com. He's also on Facebook. He's like, got some really great videos on Facebook. I was watching a couple.
And Instagram.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Which is usually my preferred channel of choice. So I was really interested to check out his Instagram.
So on Facebook, it's Never Binge Again, but then Instagram is Livingston Glenn. On Instagram. So that's his Instagram handle, is Livingston Glenn. All right. So you guys, all those links will be up on addictedtofitnesspodcast.com with the notes from our interview. Yep. And like we said in the beginning, please check out the shop page, some goodies there. So you guys can support the podcast by supporting our affiliates, right?
Yeah.
And what else should they do?
And definitely go to iTunes the Apple Podcast.
Yep.
And subscribe and definitely leave us a review because we love hearing your feedback.
Yep.
And we do take constructive criticism. Mm-hmm. Nick says he doesn't take it very well, but I do.
Mm-hmm.
So leave your thoughts there for us, and that will also earn you a shout-out in an upcoming episode in our Listeners Talk Back section.
That's right. Just hit the stars, but then also leave a few words so we can guys give you some credit and read your rating or read your review on a future episode. Got anything else for them?
That's it.
All right. This has been another edition of the Addicted to Fitness Podcast, and we'll check you next time.
Bye-bye.
For all things Addicted to Fitness, you can check out our website, addictedtofitnesspodcast.com. You can also give us a follow on Twitter, @TheATFPodcast, and like and follow the Addicted to Fitness Podcast Facebook page. Last but not least, please give us a rating and review in the iTunes store. Thanks.